This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. The Amazon Echo is always listening, just waiting for someone to say its name, Alexa, so that it can answer your questions or maybe tell you a joke. But will Alexa do something you didn't ask it to do? And should you be creeped out by that? We're going to discuss that in about 20 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned to the radio and join us on Twitter and weigh in as well. We are at KUOW. Our top story this hour, there is a public sector union in Seattle that's been working without a contract for almost 3 years. The union leaders say the city is mistreating them, steamrolling them, ignoring their bargaining rights. The city says it's the union that's being stubborn, selfish. Yesterday, a federal judge weighed in. The judge suggested that the union is capable of blackmailing the people of Seattle. I'm talking about the police officers' union, and we have on the line the president of the union, Kevin Stuckey. Officer Stuckey, welcome to you.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
The city is on this mission to make reforms to its police department. Why are your officers' bargaining rights worth making that process difficult?
Well, I would ask you what your definition of reform is, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, I would say we're not making anything difficult. I would actually go out to say that every reform that has happened because you had buy-in from the men and women of the Seattle Police Department. Everything has happened at the bargaining table. It has happened.
What reforms are those you're talking about? Because all our listeners don't know everything what's going on.
Oh, well, here's the thing. The policies, the bias free policing policy, the use of force policy, de-escalation. You want to talk about the different trainings that we've had to do. Let's not forget that the Department of Justice, Mike Diaz, actually said yesterday when asked by the federal judge if we were in compliance, and he really didn't come out and say it, but we've completed 10 of 10 assessments. Those assessments were brought forth by the consent decree saying these are the things that you need to change. Those things were changed.
Officer, for those listeners who don't know, the consent decree you're talking about, basically the federal government said that the city police department had trouble with using excessive force, the evidence of biased policing, and needed to, a federal judge is overseeing an order that the city reform its police department. But it's been a long process, and yesterday this federal judge said that the I'm trying to find his exact words. He said that that he doesn't want the citizens of Seattle, he said, are not going to pay blackmail for constitutional policing, seeming to suggest that you're holding up these federal orders in return for concessions at the bargaining table. Is that fair?
No, that's not fair, but I understand where it's coming from because that is the narrative that's being described to him. But in reality, that's not the case. That's not the case at all.
Well, let's bring in a city council member, Tim Burgess, who's with us now. Tim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Is the city breaking the rules about union contract bargaining, trying to force new duties, new reforms onto police officers who have the right to bargain for changes?
No, we're not. The current contract with our police officers expired at the end of 2014. We successfully negotiated a new contract last year. The union's board of directors approved that contract, but unfortunately, when they sent it to their membership for ratification, it was rejected, and to be fair, rejected overwhelmingly. So basically, that meant we started over, and we've been working to come to an agreement since then. But at the same time, the city has to keep functioning, and we are trying as best we can to implement what's required in the federal consent decree and to make certain that we have constitutional, fair, and effective policing in our city, and we will continue to do that.
Well, let's see how that's working for the Police Officers Guild. Kevin Stuckey, let me ask you, do you think the city and the mayor, are they being honest with you and the people of Seattle in this reform process?
I think they're being honest with what they believe reform is. I will tell you that, let me give you my definition of reform, and then I'll talk, and then we can speak on what constitutional policing is. In order to have true reform, you have to have buy-in from the rank and file, because that's how you change the culture. What we have been doing for the last 5 years. It's actually changing the culture because we have buy-in from the rank and file, which is why we've completed the assessments as fast as we have. There are other cities around this country, Oakland being one, who are in their 14th year of their consent decree. We're getting close to, I believe the judge said yesterday, 7/10 of the way. We're getting close to completion. We did that because you had buy-in from the rank and file. There was no pushback. There was no fighting. The city said this is what we need to happen. The citizens of the city have spoken. We did the changes, and we're going to continue to do the changes.
Well, then where's the resistance right now? What are we stuck on?
There's no resistance here. We are both required. All parties are supposed to operate under RCW 41.56. That's state law. That if it's a mandatory subject of bargaining, we will sit down and negotiate it.
Okay, do you then, I want to go back to City Council Member Burgess, but Kevin Stuckey, president of the union, do you think the city is using this federal order to get what they cannot get at the bargaining table?
Prior to Monday, I would have said no. After Monday, I would say that's exactly what's happening.
What happened Monday?
When the mayor made his, when he decided to do his...
Executive order,
and it's about body cameras. When we were at the table speaking about and negotiating our camera, when he went and decided to make an executive order, you circumvented the collective bargaining process.
Okay, let me pause there. I want to get back to that question about body cameras, but Councilmember Tim Burgess, is the what's your response? Is the city improperly trying to get through a federal order what it can't get in the normal process of bargaining, telling the union, officers, we want you to do this. Now you make an offer or make a counteroffer.
I don't believe so. I mean, Officer Stuckey is right in his comments about cultural change in the police department. It does require the buy-in of the rank and file, and I think the mayor, myself, most of my colleagues are incredibly pleased with how the changes have proceeded in the police department under Chief O'Toole's leadership and with the support of the union and officers who are on the street every day doing their jobs. We have seen remarkable advances, and those have been positive and they've been effective, and our officers from the rank and file level all the way up through the command staff have embraced those changes. That's all good. We're not quite there yet. We still have some things to do. The body camera issue is one of those, and I think the mayor reached a point where he was frustrated with the progress of negotiations, and he had to weigh in his mind the importance of collective bargaining and doing that well with the public safety requirements and public trust requirements that we as leaders of city government have to the people of Seattle, and he made a call to order those deployed, which will begin this coming weekend.
At the same time, we
recognize that we have to bargain the effects of that decision.
Right. That's what I want to know. What are the effects of wearing body cameras? Union President Stuckey, why do you have to be forced to wear body cameras? Why is this an issue?
Well, see, we don't have to. Well, let's change the language there, because we don't have to be forced to wear the body camera. We were actually negotiating in good faith. And the reality is this. Whenever the city has come to us and said, body cameras, just last December, they came to us and they said, "Hey, look, we need a pilot program." We were in the middle of our negotiations for the contract that Councilman correctly said they had failed, and had to start over. We set aside a day that we were supposed to be on that contract to come up with a pilot program. Now, what was asked for was for 90 days, not 180, not 365. You asked for 90 days. We gave it to you.
Is it a hardship for the mayor to force body cameras on you now?
Let me finish. We did it for them. We gave it. And at the end of the 90 days, we would sit down and talk about a permanent. The end of the 90 days was March. So from March to Monday, that's most negotiations last between 8 months and a year. We were doing it in faith under the collective bargaining agreement, under RCW 41.56.
I think our listeners might want to know why this is important to officers. Is the wearing of body cameras a hardship of some kind that you want to stand up for your rights here?
Well, it's not necessarily about this. Body cameras are a piece of the police equipment that if they want me to wear, then they want me to wear. The mayor did his executive order.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna we're professional. Come Saturday, the councilman is correct. Come Saturday, the order was written and it said, "All right, body cameras start." All right, body cameras start. Our officers will wear them. They're professional. We'll continue to wear them. We're going to do what we are instructed to do.
Okay.
My job as the union president is to go, okay, well, we still are without a contract. Now, Councilman was saying how great the men and women are and that how they were pleased with the work we've done. So you reward all the great work we've done. You reward the people who've actually done and have embraced the change. That this is how you treat them?
Okay, so
you want to shove it down their throats?
Councilmember Burgess, you can hear the Officers Union president saying, we're cooperating. Is the city shoving something down their throats?
No. And I understand Officer Stuckey's angst about this, but there's a bigger issue here, and it's very important, and I know the mayor feels very strongly about this, and the city council does as well. We are going to use the tools and the resources we have to make certain that the people of Seattle can have the highest level of trust possible in their police officers. Body cameras are a device that will help do that.
Okay, two more questions because we're running out of time. Tim Burgess, what did the judge mean when he said, quote, the citizens of Seattle are not going to pay blackmail for constitutional policing? What do you think is going on there? Is there blackmail happening?
I would not use that word, but I think what he's referring to is what he said way back at the very beginning of this process and what myself and other council members have said, and that is that we have a minimum standard for constitutional policing and what's necessary to make sure that's happening, and we shouldn't have to pay for that.
Okay. Okay, Union President Kevin Stuckey, last question to you. You mentioned that there was another city that has been at this reform process for 14 years. How long is it going to take for Seattle to get this done?
Well, that's not a question that I can answer, but I will tell you this. And this is the thing I said from the very beginning. Because all those wonderful things that Seattle has completed, as a member of the Community Police Commission, I had a factor into it. The men and women of the Seattle Police Department have not paused, not stumbled, or not prohibited the reform process from moving forward. We have taken part in it. The councilman said that we have to have buy-in. Well, how is this getting buy-in from the rank and file? Buy-in is sitting down and bringing everyone to the table and saying, okay, let all the adults in the room, let's come up with something. If there was urgency in there, then it should have been like, there's some urgency. This is not going to get the buy-in that's needed to actually get the culture change. And that's what I fear. But we're professionals. We're going to do exactly what we were asked to do. Because we're going to continue to follow the state law, the law that governs this state. We're going to follow it.
Okay, Seattle, this is the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Kevin Stuckey, and Seattle City Council member Tim Burgess talking about this ongoing process of the City of Seattle and the Police Department trying to follow along with this federal order to reform the Seattle Police Department. Tim and Kevin, thanks to both of you for this time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll keep following this issue, of course, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. And the record, this program is going to continue in a moment. On KUOW's The Record, let's discuss now what's going on with immigration in this country. This week, the Supreme Court ordered a rehearing of a case that could decide how long the federal government can keep immigrants in detention centers. And here's a remarkable trend. Most of the people stuck in immigration detention centers are men, but since last year, arrests of women are up 35%. Some of those women in detention will be pregnant. Reporter Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team looks at one story from the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma and the questions it raises about women in detention.
She wears a yellow uniform, her long hair braided in the front, her handshake timid. We talk in a small meeting room, along with her attorney and an interpreter.
My name is Jacinta Morales Remigio, I'm from Michoacán.
Jacinta Morales has spent 6 weeks here so far, inside this detention center run by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. She was picked up near her home outside Portland, Oregon. Morales's time in detention is marked by deep loss, but it didn't completely start that way.
Cuando vine aquí me hicieron una prueba de orina y salió positivo.
When I got here, they did a urine test and it came out positive.
Estaba feliz y todo porque
I was thrilled to be pregnant and thrilled at the prospect of being a mother again and having Gonzalo's baby.
Gonzalo is her longtime partner. The baby was just 4 weeks along. Medical records confirm the details of her care. She has a prenatal appointment a few days after her arrival, and a doctor note reads, quote, her greatest concern is being deported without her 11-year-old son. Her son is a U.S. citizen. Gonzalo is caring for him now. A few days later, Morales finds out she's on the flight roster to be deported.
The day that ICE told me that I would be leaving in a week's time, I started to cry. And I had pains and I felt nausea.
She saw a doctor and says she felt better. Then, a few days later, Morales woke up bleeding.
And after an hour, I went to the doctor.
Y me metieron en un cuarto así, esperando todavía, y me estaba desangrando demasiado.
And they put me in a room like this one, and I was really bleeding hard.
Y cuando me hablaron,
the officer asked me if I was feeling a lot of pain, and I said yes. And she said, I'm going to go and see if they can see you quickly.
Morales guesses she waited another hour while other women are seen. She says one had a toothache. In medical notes timestamped around noon, Morales rates her pain 10 out of 10. The doctor orders a hospital ambulance. It's slow to come, so they take her in the back of a patrol car, sitting up. She says it makes the bleeding worse. At the hospital, Morales learns she's had a miscarriage.
Mi único consuelo era para salir.
My only consolation, once I got out of this place, was to have my baby.
Pues ahorita ya no, ya no lo tengo.
And now I don't have him.
Tengo otro que me está esperando.
But I have another who is waiting.
Es mi única
esperanza. That's the only hope, the only thing I'm hanging on to.
Morales' situation raises questions about ICE's policy concerning pregnant and nursing mothers. An Obama-era policy, updated in 2016, says they will generally not be detained. But new enforcement guidelines under President Trump expand ICE's reach and eliminate some old rules. Megan Casey is Morales' attorney.
In terms of her pregnancy, former guidance would have encouraged ICE to release her.
Casey is with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. She says as policies have shifted, it's created confusion about how ICE handles some categories of people, like dreamers or asylum seekers. As Casey took up Morales' case, she says it was unclear how the new guidelines apply to pregnant women.
I have requested her release on three different occasions, essentially appealing to humanitarian factors in her situation, and they have denied my requests three different times.
In an email to KUOW, an ICE spokeswoman confirms the guidelines for pregnant women have not changed, and under this policy, pregnant women can be held in detention for some criminal offenses or if they've already been ordered deported. That could apply to Morales. She was arrested for domestic violence a year ago after police responded to a dispute with her current partner, Gonzalo. That led to her immigration case, then a judge recently ordered her deported after she missed a court date. At the Northwest Detention Center, Jacinta Morales struggles with depression. She barely leaves her dorm room.
It's
a place where I would not wish any woman to be in at all. It makes you feel desperate.
Families at risk of deportation have generally thought of women and mothers as less targeted by ICE, but that idea has vanished under the Trump administration. In the first 4 months of this year, ICE arrests of women climbed 35% from the previous year, and about 300 pregnant women were held in detention.
I would say that they should take proper care of all pregnant women, because I don't wish what happened to me on any other woman.
Morales understands miscarriages are common in early pregnancies like hers. Still, she thinks more could have been done.
I think so. If they'd been able to stop the bleeding, I think that perhaps they might have been able to save my baby and I would have my baby.
Some studies also suggest that stress might contribute to miscarriages. It's ICE's policy to routinely reevaluate pregnant women to determine if detention is necessary. In June, an immigration judge granted Morales an unusually low bond of $1,500. It took her partner several weeks to raise the money with help from a local charity. Morales is now at home with her son in Oregon. Her deportation case is still pending. In Seattle, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and I would love for you to hop on Twitter right now, at KUOW, because I'm really curious how you're going to react to this story. This shot across the internet earlier this summer. You may have seen this. A man in New Mexico threatened his girlfriend with a gun, and while he was threatening her, he asked whether she had called the police. In their home, an Amazon Echo device was listening to all of this. And the Echo, also known as Alexa, heard the man ask about the police, and the Echo called the police on its own. At least that's the way New Mexico authorities reported it, and that's how the media reported it. Except it could not have happened that way. The Echo can't do that. And my next guest says all those headlines about an Amazon Echo that woke up and made a decision on its own made a lot of people uncomfortable. Emily Dreyfus is a senior staff writer at Wired. Emily, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Why were people so uncomfortable when they thought that Alexa had called the police on its own?
Well, it was interesting. At first, people heralded Alexa as a hero because
right.
it appeared that the device may have saved someone's life. And then in the next breath, people realized, but wait, do we want to live in a world where these always listening devices are making decisions without being told to explicitly by us? And I think the answer to that question is definitely not. We don't want to live in that world right now. And the reason is, you know, manifold, but namely, we don't want our privacy infringed upon. And also, there is a huge fear that were you to empower these devices that are in the most intimate settings of our lives, in our homes, in our bedrooms, in our kitchens, if we were to empower them to act of their own accord, perhaps they would overreact. Perhaps they would do the wrong thing that would cause actual damage in the real world.
It also reminded us that if for those people who have this Echo device in their homes, we kind of know that it must be listening because it's waiting for its for the name Alexa to start to kick into gear, but we don't want to think of it as really always listening to us.
Exactly. I mean, so, you know, to briefly explain how it works for people who
please.
May not have one of these in their homes. So it's a device. Amazon has the Echo, but Google has a competing product called the Google Home. And what they do is they have a microphone that's always listening for what's called a wake word. And with the Echo, you can have it be Alexa, computer, Amazon, or there's another one.
Dude.
Yes.
I made that up.
But either way, you have to set it up. And so it's always listening, but what it hears before it hears its own name, it does not store on Amazon's servers. So it just saves that information on its own little hard drive in your living room and then deletes it later. But once the device hears the word Alexa and it is now activated, everything you say after that moment is recorded and saved by Amazon so that Amazon can later use it to calibrate the device to make it smarter, and also so that it can send the information about what you said to third-party developers who make apps for Alexa. And there has even been a report this week that Amazon is considering sending the raw audio files that are saved after it hears that wake word to those third-party developers rather than just a transcript, which appears to be what it does right now. People aren't that worried about that because usually if you say, Alexa, do something, and then it stores it, what you're saying is pretty mundane. Like, you know, maybe you're embarrassed that you asked it to play The Doors, but it's not the most intimate detail. But with the risk would be that if it were recording or making decisions about what it heard before you said its name or its wake word, then it would hear absolutely everything going on in your life.
You know, you have tracked, in a way, our societal comfort with this whole idea, Emily. I mean, you were kind of creeped out when you first encountered this idea of a listening gadget.
Absolutely. I recall, you know, a couple of years ago, the first time I was in a room with someone who had a Google smartwatch. And I'm not sure if you remember, but a couple of years ago, smartwatches were, you know, the next big thing.
Yeah.
And with those watches, you can say, okay, Google, and it'll do something, make a phone call, tell you what time it is. And I had been in conversation with this person for, you know, probably an hour when he demonstrated that his watch could do that, at which point I realized his watch had been listening to our entire conversation, and I was fully creeped out. And I thought, you know, wow, we should be having a discussion as a society about whether you should disclose such a thing if you are wearing a device like that.
Right.
Now, jump to 2 years in the future, I am a proud or happy consumer of having an Alexa Echo. I have the Amazon Echo in my house. And I think that that just goes to show that we as a society, as you say, we really are becoming more inured to the idea of letting not just governments, but also companies listen in to our lives.
We got a tweet from someone who's listening in to us right now. We're being listened to, Emily. And Kimberly says, no one is allowed to yell at our Alexa or be rude to her. We're currying favor for when robot overlords are in charge. And actually, that does get me to the idea, to the slippery slope idea about robot overlords. And it's sometimes helpful to just be more specific. What is an actual realistic worst case scenario, you think?
Okay, so I mean, a worst case scenario with this kind of like listening technology that can then trigger an action via the internet. That's, you know, what we're really talking about here. Alexa is connected to the internet and therefore can do some things once you tell it to. A worst case scenario would be, let's say I'm talking in my house about being pregnant, for instance. Alexa could hear that information and sell it to a company that wanted to target me for products about pregnancy. Or,
well, what's the worst thing about that? We already know about targeted advertising, right? You know, I see websites that kind of know what I've searched or shopped for.
Sure. I mean, that is just sort of creepy. But worse than that is, imagine if the person or the group that data was being sold to was not an advertiser, but was a health insurance company. Let's say. And perhaps the thing I was talking about wasn't that I was pregnant, but rather that I'm overweight. And now they're going to raise my premiums because Alexa has told them that I am obese. You know, I mean, this is a hypothetical that is not at all outside the realm of what is technologically possible.
Right, especially when there's a financial interest. Things get possible.
Yeah.
I want to know, we're talking with Emily Dreyfuss, who's a senior staff writer at Wired, and the title of your piece is "An Amazon Echo Can't Call the Police, But Maybe It Should." Why should Echo call the cops?
Well, I think the most compelling reason why Amazon Echo should be able to call the police is demonstrated by the story that you were talking about that happened earlier this week, where the Bernalillo police who reported to that domestic dispute, they believed that they had been called by an Amazon Echo. And then the press picked up the story very credulously, believing that that was the case. And so to me, if people are going to believe that you're able to call the cops using a device, because it doesn't sound absurd that you would be able to, then probably that device should be able to do it. Because what if you're in a home where you assume you have access to the authorities because there's an Amazon Echo there, but you actually don't, because it's not right now hooked up to the phone network that makes these things work. It's not like, you know, I'm talking to you right now on an iPhone. My iPhone has Siri, which is also, you know, a listening personal assistant. But because it's on my phone, it's capable of calling the police. I spoke to a lot of police people and experts who work with people who are at risk, like trying to prevent suicide and other forms of domestic violence. And they are all in favor of these devices being empowered with the ability to call the police. They see it as, you know, just the next level of technological advancement. You can currently text certain police departments, which is very advantageous in cases where there may be someone in your home who you don't want to hear you on the phone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are some downsides to it. An ethicist I spoke to, and a lot of people had pointed out to me that one of the major reasons why you perhaps wouldn't want to empower the device to be able to call the police when you asked is that you know, children might prank it, might, you know, this device is sitting in your kitchen and, yes. you know, I have a 2-year-old, he might say, Alexa, call the police. But cops that I ran that idea past said, well, hey, we get pranked by kids all the time.
Right.
And it's really no hair off our back and it won't really change anything if Alexa is able to do it.
Well, then finally, Emily, I suppose it comes down to trust. And I'm calling you from Seattle, home of Amazon, and you say there are other gadgets as well. But how do you decide whether to trust Amazon, et cetera, with this power?
Right. It absolutely comes down to trust. And, you know, to Amazon's credit, they have been very outspoken about the fact that they will never have Amazon Echo be able to make decisions on its own without its wake word. And one of the reasons, you know, perhaps you should be skeptical of a corporation when they say, I'm just going to work in your best interest, because, you know, all corporations are really just trying to make money when it comes down to it. But the thing is, if Amazon were, or Google, or any of the people who make these devices, were to cross the line into allowing these devices to have autonomy, and to make decisions without being explicitly asked, there would, I think, be a revolt in the market. So it would actually, they have no incentive to allow this to happen because consumers are not ready for it. Perhaps, you know, 10 years down the line we will be, but right now we absolutely are not. And
yeah.
Amazon has...
That's the hope I'm hanging on to as well.
Yes, me too.
Aren't we all? Emily Dreyfus, who wrote this piece in Wired, an Amazon Echo can't call the police, but maybe it should. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you for this, Emily.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW is The Record. Thanks for tuning in and joining us on Twitter. I'd love to hear more reactions from people like Kimberly, and maybe you've got a thought as well, at KUOW. On the radio at KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Bill Radke with The Record. We're also on Twitter. And again, I'd be curious your questions for my next guests. We are at KUOW. If you have ever had to get ready for a surgery, your doctor probably told you stuff like wear comfortable clothes, don't wear jewelry into the operating room. Dr. Andrew Wright could probably recite surgery prep guidelines in his sleep. He is the director of the UW Medicine Hernia Center at Northwest Hospital, but none of those guidelines applied to a patient he operated on last month, who came in completely naked, by the way, was very hairy and smelly. Your words, Dr. Ryan?
Quite smelly.
Uh-huh, quite smelly, and could lift a minivan if he felt like it?
I think he could throw a minivan, not just lift it.
Dr. Wright, how did you find yourself performing hernia surgery on a gorilla?
So VIP is the gorilla's name. It stands for very important primate, and he's one of the gorillas at the Woodland Park Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
So VIP stopped eating, and he was picking at his abdomen and not feeling well. And the zookeepers noticed pretty quickly that he wasn't doing well. So the zookeepers and the veterinarian at the zoo sort of pulled everybody in and gave me a call because they were worried about his abdomen. And I got a call on a Saturday morning to come in and examine the gorilla.
But you're not a veterinarian.
That's correct.
Don't they have veterinarians for this?
So veterinarians, the vets at the zoo are fantastic. So I just have to say that. But, you know, gorillas are more similar to humans than like a giraffe or a hippopotamus. So the zoo is very free in bringing in experts in other fields to come in and take care of their primates.
Wow. Okay. So you went into the zoo. You went into the gorilla enclosure. Why did you do that? What was that like?
So VIP had been anesthetized. They actually made him sleepy. You know, they try to keep VIP from being afraid of people. So if I walk in, I start poking and prodding him while he's awake and can feel pain, then he would associate that with the unpleasant experience with a person. So he was anesthetized when we went in to examine him. We walked in through the back of the zoo, which was a fantastic experience. I'd never been backstage at the zoo. That was really a unique thing. But we examined him right in the zoo enclosure while he was asleep. And within a few seconds, it was pretty obvious he needed emergency surgery.
You've talked about the so you go into this enclosure. I'm just curious what I haven't gone through the back door either. Right. So what was that like for you?
Well, the first thing that hits you, especially with the gorillas, is the smell. It's a primal.
That I'm familiar with, but it's yeah. It's extra ripe.
It is extra, and it's just this primal experience. It makes you feel like you're, you know, the prey instead of the alpha predator. It puts you in your place in the world. The smell hit you first, and then just the experience of walking in and seeing this majestic, enormous animal. I mean, Vip weighs 450 pounds, and it's all muscle. It's just such a powerful animal.
Mm.
And then the responsibility, because Vip really is a very important primate. He's part of the breeding program, the conservation program the zoo runs. So feeling that responsibility for a really quite important animal, patient.
As I say, we're on Twitter at KUOW. We're also on Facebook, where Jan wants to know what caused the hernia. What did, was there some event or activity that the gorilla did, that Vip did?
Yeah, so hernias can happen, in humans at least, can happen at any age. We see them in newborns all the way up to folks in their 80s and 90s. It's a congenital weakness. So most people are born with a little area of weakness that over time blows out, like a bald spot on a tire might blow out. We don't know if he lifted something heavy or if he did something different. I mean, you can't really control a gorilla's activity. They pretty much do what they want.
Right. So let's talk about the experience of doing this surgery. How much was it like doing Norm the Carpenter's hernia? And how, I mean, were you scared?
So surgeons are trained to focus very much on what's in front of you. We have to. You can't be distracted by extraneous things. So the process of getting ready for surgery and after surgery, there were a lot of sort of nerves and trembling and excitement more than nerves. But when you're actually operating, you are in the zone. It's like an athlete. You have to be focused and in the zone. And really, operating on Vip was just like operating on a person. The anatomy is very similar, the steps of the operation, even the equipment in the operating room at the zoo, exactly like being in a human operating room.
Any difference at all?
No difference. You know, they have sterile gowns and gloves and drapes and sterile instruments. And the only thing we had to bring in on our own, we'll often use mesh, which is an artificial material to help patch a hernia to give it some more strength. And the zoo obviously doesn't keep that in stock. So we talked with one of our companies that I work with, Cook, that donated this several $1,000 piece of mesh that we could use for Vip.
What was your relationship like with your anesthesiologist? Because I really want to trust that person to really get it right. And if you err on the side of maybe giving the gorilla, 450-pound gorilla, a little too much, put you under juice, I might be okay with that.
So
did you go through the scenario with the anesthesiologist? Vip wakes up, rips the tubes out, climbs on the table, beats his chest, destroys the operating room. That scenario, did that come up?
It didn't. So first of all, if you look at the photos, Vip has enormous teeth. So it's not just the size of the muscles. This is a little bit of an intimidating specimen.
Yeah.
But, you know, the veterinarians handled the anesthesia and kept Vip asleep and comfortable during the whole procedure. So I wasn't so much worried during the operation. But waking him up, that's a different story because, you know, you pull out the breathing tube, you let him wake up from anesthesia. And
Vip.
Even humans
Vip.
Get a
you want to go.
Crazy
you want to take that real slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, we took it fairly fast and they woke him up and then we all ran away. So.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Well, not we walked quickly.
You backed up.
We backed away.
With intention.
That's right.
Wow. So did you do the surgery on the same table that someone's going to have a knee replacement an hour later, like in your normal operating room?
The Woodland Park Zoo actually has an animal hospital on site.
Oh, you did it there?
Yeah. So I examined Vip in the enclosure, in the gorilla enclosure, and when it became apparent that he needed surgery, the zoo actually has an ambulance. It looks just like a human ambulance. So we loaded Vip up into the ambulance and carted him through the back road of the zoo to the animal hospital and did the surgery there.
What about recuperation after surgery? How does that look different for Vip the gorilla than for Bill the human?
So most people after surgery are, they're slow to get up, they're slow to move, they're sore, they're achy, they don't really want to be that active. And in fact, with humans, you have to encourage them to get up and out of bed and start walking. Vip just sort of woke up and did what he does. You know, it's hard to keep a gorilla down. So
Is there a lesson there?
Yeah, it's an interesting lesson in psychology, because I think as humans, a lot of pain and a lot of the suffering after surgery is psychological. We think that we're supposed to be hurting, and we think that we can't move, and we think we have to lay still. VIP really teaches us you can get up and start moving and start eating right after even major surgery. And so we're working that on humans. We have something called enhanced recovery after surgery in people, where we're trying to get them up and moving and eating much more quickly after surgery than we used to.
No kidding. It's not just okay. I can get that it might be okay for a patient who can throw a minivan, but do you want us human patients to be more physical and up and at it? And yeah, we're animals too, and you got hurt, get on with it.
So my human patients, I give them homework, even in the hospital. The day after surgery, I give them, you have to do this many laps around the nursing station. You have to do this many minutes up and out of bed. So we want people to get up and moving right after surgery.
Well, how's VIP doing?
VIP's doing great. I got to go back in and do a post-op check and actually fed him. My partner, Dr. Rob Yates, one of the other surgeons at the Hernia Center, assisted me in surgery. So Rob and I got to go and feed VIP. And it turns out VIP really likes yogurt, which I would not have expected. So we got to feed VIP some yogurt drinks, and he was doing very well.
No bananas?
Peanuts and yogurt. He might eat bananas, but I didn't get to feed him any bananas.
So you went home, and what was that like after that day at the office?
So that
Dad, you stink.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't my daughters that freaked out. It was actually my dog. So, you know, I came home smelling like gorilla, and I have a little beagle, and I walked in the door, and Tulip the beagle just, she kept spinning around in circles. She didn't know what to think, and she wouldn't quite come up to me, but she wouldn't run around either. So it was just around and around and around in circles till I went and took a shower.
Thanks for telling. That's a great story. Good luck to VIP and good luck to his surgeon. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Andrew Wright, director at the University of Washington Medical Hernia Center, all in a day's work. You ever going to operate on an animal again?
I'm available if the zoo needs me. I'm happy to help.
Did you hear that? He's available. Dr. Andrew Wright, great to speak with you.
Thank you.
KUOW is The Record, back in a moment. A few minutes ago on KUOW's The Record, we were talking about Seattle's attempt at police reform. There is this federal order, this federal consent decree. Seattle has an independent monitor that has been praising the police officers of the city of Seattle for doing good work in reducing their use of force. The monitor also finds improvements in how Seattle police approach people in mental health crisis. But the shooting of Charlena Lyles by Seattle police has the city's candidates for mayor asking, what has really changed? And what can be learned now? KUOW's Amy Radel has more.
When it comes to policing, there's a lot of history in the race for Seattle mayor. Two of the candidates, Jenny Durkin and Mike McGinn, have faced off before. They negotiated the consent decree between the Justice Department and the city of Seattle. Durkin was the local U.S. attorney then, and McGinn was mayor. 5 years into that decree, Durkin says SPD is a leader in dealing with people in crisis.
The statistics show that we've come a long way. There's no question that the number of times now that force is used in those situations is less.
The new question is how Lyle's death squares with these statistics.
You know, it was just an incredible tragedy, the shooting, and I think it shows that no matter how much you can accomplish on police reforms, there is always more you can do, and you must learn from the incidents where there's a tragedy or things go wrong.
Mike McGinn says the confusion about whether an officer should have had a taser when he answered Lyle's call makes him wonder about the state of police reform.
All of this tells me that the training and the use of force decisions and policies really aren't where they should be. And that gives me just a great degree of concern when I have heard our elected officials and the DOJ saying everything's going great.
McGinn says he's not putting his hopes on the federal consent decree, which is temporary, but on the city's now permanent community oversight group.
And what we need is a strong and independent community police commission with some of the strongest community advocates on it who are challenging the elected officials as to whether progress is really being made and holding them accountable.
Reform advocates have also suggested making contract negotiations between the mayor and the police officers' unions more transparent. State Senator and former Teamsters leader Bob Hasegawa says negotiating in public doesn't work, but you can bring community representatives to the bargaining table.
I believe that there should be trusted advocates for stakeholders in those negotiations. If you just open things up to a media show, people are playing more to the microphones and the cameras than actually trying to come to solutions.
Mayoral candidate Nikita Oliver says the Lyles case has highlighted the need for more civilian oversight of police.
When we look at the Charlena Lyles killing, we still lack an effective way for civilians to be a part of the investigation.
She says the city has made strides under the consent decree, but Seattle is in something of a gray area right now. The city has passed but not yet implemented new police accountability legislation. Oliver still sees a lot of hurdles to her vision of what she calls policing transformation.
Which is really what I'm calling for, is transforming how the institution of policing works and how we hold that institution accountable.
While Oliver says civilians need a stronger role in police oversight, another candidate for mayor says rank-and-file police officers feel ignored too. James Norton is a Seattle police officer who's taken a leave of absence to run for mayor. He says the outcry over the police shooting of John T. Williams in 2010 led to a top-down reform plan with little input from officers.
It comes from the wrong place. You know, the place should be, oh my God, this is a tragedy. How do we not let it happen again? Instead of, you know, you're going to do this. This is the way we think it should be done. That's not fair to anybody.
Norton says SPD's crisis team is understaffed. He'd like to expand the number of mental health professionals teaming up with police officers to crisis calls. Norton says those professionals could increase public trust by providing their own account of each incident. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And finally, we want to give you a quick picture of life in our northern neighbor. There is a brand new leader of British Columbia, and the man has got some issues. We have Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer here. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
What are a few of the challenges your new premier is immediately going to have to deal with?
Well, he's stepping into office, took the oath yesterday. Bill, John Horgan, just had a press conference with him here at the legislature buildings in Victoria, dealing with a crisis in the province. So we were having one of the worst wildfire seasons we've had in many years. You've got tens of thousands of people in the central part of British Columbia out of their homes on evacuation, thousands more on notice. Over 100 fires burning at the moment in different parts of British Columbia. And so the government has announced immediately expanding relief for financial relief for people who are out of their homes, extended a state of emergency in the province for another 2 weeks. Some of our provincial parks are closed. So not something that John Horgan planned to be dealing with when he ran for office in the spring, but here he is, premier, and one of the first things he has to do is a crisis with wildfires.
We've also talked so many times, Vaughn, you and I, about the idea of expanding this oil pipeline to Vancouver that's going to put more tankers through the San Juan, Strait of Juan de Fuca. Where does John Horgan, the new premier, stand on that?
He says he will do everything in the provincial government's power to stop that project from going ahead. He is consulting with his new Attorney General, David Eby, who I see out my window as I speak to you, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Legal advice, what are the options? There is a very large court case going ahead in Canada this fall in federal court. They've taken all the different court filings opposed to this project, consolidated them into a single case. And the British Columbia government will likely be seeking intervener status in that case, so they could make arguments there. The case has a bunch of complexities to it, Bill, but the central one is that the environmental approval for this project to go ahead was badly flawed, and the project should be stopped and the approval reversed. So that's probably where Horgan will go at first. Until that court case is settled, actual construction is not likely to begin.
Well, Vaughn, if you don't like oil pipelines and fossil fuels, then maybe you like hydroelectric dams. We can certainly relate to that in Puget Sound area, but that's a big issue facing your new premier.
You'd think that if, emissions-free electrical generation would be the option if you don't like oil and you don't like natural gas and that sort of thing. Coal-fired generation is out in British Columbia. But no, there's a very large hydroelectric dam under construction at a place called Site C on the Peace River in northeastern BC, and Horgan is sending that project for review to the Independent Utilities Commission here in British Columbia, asking whether he should stop it or let it continue. Look, that project is well underway, Bill. I've toured the site. 2,500 people working there as we speak, constructing this dam, but the government is considering putting a stop to it if the commission says the power isn't needed right now and that there are options that are better, like wind, say, or solar or geothermal.
Wow, that's vivid. 2,500 people working there, $7 billion American dollars for this dam. And finally, we just have less than a minute left, Vaughn. You've got, we have an opioid crisis here. You've got it maybe as bad or worse in BC.
Awful. 100 people a month dying of fentanyl overdoses in British Columbia. The government has established a new ministry to deal with mental health and drug addictions. And the new minister, Judy Darcy, is going to be in charge of trying to do something about this crisis. There's a, it's not an easy thing to deal with, obviously, but the death toll is terrifying here.
Wishing you luck there, the new premier of British Columbia and the people of BC. That is Vaughn Palmer of the Vancouver Sun. Vaughn, always good to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And thanks for listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and joining us on Facebook and Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke.